Murder-suicide is the kind of tragedy that leaves all of us asking why. That's what we're figuring out by talking to the people who've lived through it. Unlike the often sensational coverage of true crime in the media, our goal is to give our viewers and our listeners an inside and accurate look at murder-suicide, the risk factors, the personal experience, and the aftermath. On our podcast, the experts are the people who've lived through it. Welcome to The Final Act. I'm Dr. Joni Johnson, a forensic psychologist and private investigator. I also bring somewhat of a personal, experience to this topic to some extent, that I have suicide in my family. So this is a topic that's very personal and very important to me. And I'm also very, very happy to have my co-host join me, Jacqueline Jameson, who's been a mental health professional for the past 25 years and 10 years ago lost her daughter to murder-suicide. Great to see you again, Jackie, as always.
You too, Joni. It's great to be here. And it seems like we just did this, but that's great. I think the more stories we have and the more experts we have on really gives us a lot of insight into just the layers and layers of complexities around murder-suicide.
That is so true. I mean, I find myself, you know, every time we're recording, looking to see how many people have been lost since we last spoke. And it's just breaks my heart, you know, whenever I see cases involving families and especially when children are lost. That is, I think, particularly difficult. The other thing that you mentioned, some of the layers that we're uncovering and discovering as we go through this podcast series, and today's guest, I think, brings a very interesting complexity in that it involves law enforcement and the fact that not only was the victim a law enforcement officer, sheriff, but the perpetrator was a law enforcement mm-hmm. officer. And I could only imagine how much that might complicate things.
Oh, 100%. You know, I don't know that it's much different from anybody else who maybe is seen as a protector or a helper. Even in my instance, really, you know, I'm a licensed professional, and my ex, who was my perpetrator, was also a licensed mental health professional. So I think when we are in these roles and when people see us in these roles, it's almost sort of aghast to think, how could this have happened? You know, weren't there signs? How come nobody stopped it? Why didn't they tell anyone? They should have known, you know. So there are a lot of questions here that sometimes get left unanswered. But there's also a lot of stigma. So I think, at least in my case, and I guess we'll find out here too, we don't speak up sometimes because of stigma.
And I think that applies not only in terms of people who are concerned about a loved one, but I think oftentimes the people who wind up becoming perpetrators, because I know in talking to several friends of mine who are in law enforcement, what a challenge it is for them to ask for help if they are struggling with anything. And because there is that stigma around getting help if you're in law enforcement, and also just this fear that if I talk about this or talk about my feelings, my gun's going to be taken away, or I'm going to be given mm-hmm. a desk job or put on leave. And so I absolutely. Think there's that part of it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I have family members who are both in law enforcement and who provide services to law enforcement, and they do live in that fear for sure, asking for help and what will happen? What will the outcome of that be?
And I think that, you know, I think that progress has been made. There's been a lot of efforts, I know, to, you know, I think more and more police agencies or organizations are having psychologists that are on staff. I have a couple of friends who actually do that. But I think it's still, I think, a challenge. And I do think there is that fear. And I think often, I think sometimes there is perceived lack of trust that even if my, you know, commander or lieutenant is saying, if you need help, get help, I'm not sure I trust that in terms of what that's going to mean for me in my career.
Sure. And I think this is maybe a message that needs to go out more broadly at some point. So maybe that's something we can talk about in the future too, is, you know, the training aspect, the education, the awareness to those people, the people that make the decisions about people who are struggling, and, you know, what is the stigma, and have those conversations in person with those people.
I agree. And also, you know, if there's a stigma around getting help, I would imagine there is certainly a stigma if you're worried about somebody that's mm-hmm. your partner, or you're seeing things that are concerning, I'm sure that would be somewhat inhibiting as well to try to get that person help or go to your supervisor and say, I'm really worried about Joe or I'm worried about Joanne or whatever. I'm concerned about some of the things that he or she is saying.
Right, right. Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing more from our expert here.
Yeah, let's get Bruce on. He's the star of our show, as always. I know he's going to really have a lot to share with us. Hi, Bruce.
Hello, Joni. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome to the show. We're so happy that you agreed to come on and share your story with us.
Welcome, Bruce.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you start out before we talk about your story? Tell us a little bit about you, your background, what you did for a living, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. I'm a former commercial real estate construction manager. Worked for a succession of real estate developers and a private consultancy in the Washington, D.C. area, where it was based anyway. Worked nationally for a career, an entire career. Had an undergraduate degree in political science that suited me and prepared me not at all for a career in commercial construction. Along the path, married my wife, Sarah, whom I met at American University in Washington, D.C. Had three kids in the D.C. area, raised them all, decided I should get a law degree on the way. So while working full-time by day, went at night for 4 years, practiced law for 2.5 years in the real estate sector, and got recruited back into the bricks and sticks, as we call it, world of commercial real estate and construction. And now I'm retired.
And so I know we're here today talking mainly about Abby, your daughter. So maybe take us through your journey through what happened with her.
Abby, our youngest of three, two older brothers, graduated from the University of Maryland, decided to join the same police force her oldest brother was then serving in the Montgomery County Police Department outside of Maryland. And in the course of applying, was rejected because she ate one half of a marijuana-laced cookie in Colorado where it was legal some year and a half, I think it was, or so before applying, called me and said, hey, Dad, what should I do here? And I said, you got to tell him. If it comes up 10 years later, you could lose your career and pension and all that stuff. So you have to be honest. And that dinged her and kept her from joining the Montgomery County Police Department. So she moved to Florida on her own, knowing nobody, up and left, and put down roots and got a job in a law firm and applied to a local police agency, the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, which would have her after only, I think it was 2 years between the consumption of the half a cookie, and became a deputy with the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, and had served 4 years at the time that she had met a guy on a call, another Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office deputy named Dan Layden, who she started a romantic relationship with that never firmly took root. There was always an unease about it from Abby's side. And I should say we're a very close family and she shared everything and was incredibly tight with her brothers, with me, and in particular, my wife, her mother, Sarah. And we all knew that it was not likely to go on for and mature into anything long-term. And they went away on a long weekend vacation with two other deputy couples. And she planned to break up with him on that trip. And he wasn't having that and instead shot her and killed her and then himself on that trip. And that started my journey into the whole learning about the cycles of officer-involved domestic violence, sometimes called police-perpetrated domestic violence, to be more accurate, and the lying, the subterfuge, the gaslighting, the obfuscation, and the nonsense that police agencies resort to rather than face what's painfully obvious and right in front of them and has been going on forever. And, you know, I'm on a bit of a campaign to educate and reform the policies that govern the manner by which law enforcement officers in particular are judged and held to account or not held to account, as the case may be, for their crimes and their trespasses. And there's a huge gaping hole in awareness and in treatment for the criminality of these police officers.
So when did you become first aware that Abby had met Layton and that she had started seeing him?
That's a good question. It was about, the whole relationship was 7 or 8 months, so it didn't go on for that long. So if you back 7 or 8 months off of January, then, you know, within weeks, that's when I first would have, of 2022. January of 2022 is when she was killed. So that's when we would have first learned. And we met him. He came to the house many times, the house I'm sitting in now, swam in the pool that's just a few feet from me, went to multiple dinners, and even we took him on a vacation. To, we have happened to be lucky enough to have a cabin in the woods in New Hampshire. We flew him and Abby up there, my wife and I, in November of 21, and we were thanked by his murdering her just months later. So we knew of him from the inception, fairly close to it anyway. And charming guy, sense of humor, intelligent. A guy that none of us detected anything amiss with. And her brothers are just natural, empathic, and intuitive detectives, and, you know, good, with good heads on their shoulders and solid cores and ethics and I think barometers for human personality types. And, you know, that's their job. They're both cops. I didn't mention that. And it's, you know, their livelihood depends on them having good powers of perception and being able to read people. And we all misread him. And frankly, so did his agency, because if they'd come back from the trip that neither of them came back from, the very next workday, he was starting work as a homicide detective, a fact which I think demonstrates the extent to which and the degree to which particularly manipulative and intelligent, high-functioning predators like him can just fool everybody. And I suppose in the telling of the story that you'll suss out of me, you'll find out that in fact he hadn't fooled them, because they had knowledge of his prior bad acts, his prior domestic violence predilections.
Yeah, I really want to talk about that, because I can't imagine, here you've just have received the shock of your life that your daughter, your precious baby of the family, and I know you had such a special bond with her and relationship, she's been taken away from you by somebody that you never even dreamed would do something like that. And then you and I have talked before about the fact that you then start finding out some things that are just horrendous. So maybe you can share some of that with us, Bruce, and just, it must have been like salt being poured on the wound.
Oh, very much so. It was just two days after Abby was killed. She was killed in St. Augustine, which is approximately a 3-hour or so drive from where I am outside of Tampa. And the sheriff's office saw fit to engage and organize a motorcade, a cross-state motorcade that was a whole bunch of motorcycles and police cars and sirens and shut down roads. And there was a lot of solemnity and dignity attending to the whole thing, all the way up to St. Augustine and back. And my two sons participated in it. My one son in particular, Daniel, the older boy, had many years as a firefighter and an EMT, and had, you know, taken many bodies to many morgues over the course of his career. And he had in his head this very disturbing vision that Abby was lying in a morgue, his beloved sister, probably within feet of the guy that killed her. And it so irritated and galled him that he wanted to get her away from that that guy as quickly as he could. And so they went in this motorcade. And my wife and I saw the motorcade off very early one morning, and we'd been shepherded over to its departure point by a sheriff's deputy whom we didn't know. And all of this happened 7 months after my wife and I had come to Florida to retire. So we had just barely gotten our feet under us with finding a house and all that when this happened. So we hadn't met all of Abby's friends or any, or I think one of them. Yeah. And so as this motorcade left, a deputy came up to us, was introduced to us, and I don't know what possessed me to ask him, but I asked him if he knew Dan Layden, the guy that killed Abby, and he said he did. And his reaction was sort of palpably negative. He was putting off vibes that this was a guy, clearly, other than the fact that he just killed one of his fellow deputies, I had the sense there was more there. And I gestured to the sergeant who'd driven us, and my wife would be right with him. We get back in the car to drive home, and I wanted to talk to this guy alone, and he unburdened himself very readily and said that he had, in fact, responded to a domestic violence call where Dan Layden was the subject. And it, after an initial confusing formulation of the way he put it, the information out, I came to understand, wait a minute, you're saying this guy exhibited domestic violence behavior to the extent, to the point that it generated a police call from his own agency, no less? Which is, to me, I'm not a cop, I never was a cop, but it struck me as a particularly telling indication that this is a person, if he can't control his own affairs, how and why would we expect him to be able to control the affairs of others and carry a badge and a gun that can take people's liberty, let alone lives, away in doing so? It just struck me as, it should be the last thing you'd want to do, to call your own agency and say, hey, I need help. You know, you're supposed to be the one who helps. And yet, indeed, he this deputy did confirm that is what happened. He was the subject. It was a DV call. He believed he should have been fired after this call. He said he never talked to the guy again. And it totally changed obviously we'd all been stricken by this blow from out of the blue. Our daughter was just wiped off the face of the earth. And now this was a secondary jolt. It was like, oh crap, this didn't have to happen. Somebody knew. And I didn't know who knew, and I didn't know why. You know, I didn't have the who, what, when, where, how, and why of it. I just knew this guy struck me as authentic, believable, credible. And it hit me in my heart, in my head, in my soul, that this was avoidable. This should have been stopped. And now I'm 3 years and a month or two after, and nothing I have learned, nothing has swayed me from that initial lightning bolt conclusion that it didn't have to happen, it was avoidable. I do now know, and I can put meat on the bones of how and why I know it didn't have to happen. I've learned about best practices. I've learned about policy and procedures. I've learned about the process, the phenomenon that is domestic violence, and particularly the more pernicious form, if it can be more pernicious, of officer involved, police perpetrated domestic violence. I know if the right policies and protocols had been implemented and followed, the right training had been administered, it wouldn't have happened. And I've checked that thinking, that conclusion, with the nation's preeminent experts in all of the, you know, from prosecutors to forensics psychologists to other law enforcement types to trainers to domestic violence consultants and writers, and they all agree. And I don't, you know, I'm the sad, grieving father, and there's a temptation to say, yes, Mr. Bieber, of course, you know, you're right. It shouldn't happen. Everybody, no, a young woman in the prime of her life shouldn't be struck down, ever. We can all stipulate to that, obviously. And I said to them, each of those experts, I am going to start getting sort of loud about this, because it's the only reasonable and positive response that I can come up with to such a tragic loss and death, is to say, apply what should have been learned and could have been learned so that somebody else doesn't suffer the same fate. There's no That's not brave. That's not bold. That's not particularly anything. I don't. It's just the only way to make sense of it, and to me, and I just know it is so. It is the case that somebody else is going to die because they don't listen, because they don't learn, because they won't open their eyes. And the how and the whys of that are an interesting inquiry as well. I don't know if that's responsive, but.
Mm-hmm.
I'll
Bruce,
run on for an hour if you let me. So I'll just stop.
I have some questions. First, thank you so much. I unfortunately know firsthand how difficult it is to talk about, you know, the loss of a child at someone else's hand, especially somebody that you, I guess, sort of trusted or, you know, didn't think that they would be capable of doing something like this. So I appreciate you being here and telling your story. I have a question. I have two questions, actually. One is, what county was it in Florida?
What county was it that what?
In Florida. Where were they living? You said that they were both officers in Florida?
Yeah, they were working in Hillsborough County, Florida.
Oh, Hillsborough. Okay.
It happened in St. John's County, and Abby lived in Pinellas County, which is only one.
Gotcha. Okay.
A lot of counties.
No, I was just curious yeah. about that for my own frame of reference.
And then, I'm sorry for your loss, too, by the way.
Thanks, Bruce. I appreciate that. Well, we're here talking about these things, even though they are very difficult. And I am somewhat trying to hold it together today because I'm viscerally impacted by your story. So I apologize if I tear up here a little bit. So you said that you are here now to educate and reform and look at policies. And I'm just wondering, you know, which ones have you focused on for yourself to do that around and where? You know, is it in Florida? Is it across the board? What kinds of things are you doing? And we don't have to get too deep into that right now. I wanted a little bit more information from you on that.
That's a very good question, Jackie, because when it first happened, I was on fire. You know, I just wanted to grab the entirety of the globe and say, you know, shake it by its ears and say, do you understand?
And, right.
And by the way, this is so easy. And then I got a little bit more, I suspect, reasonable and said, let's focus on Florida only. And I vowed to just limit my ambit to Florida, thinking if I could push for positive reform in this state, it's a big state, a little bit backwards right about now, but nonetheless, if I could somehow labor through this and get it done, get some legislation passed, get a bill passed that would provide for mandatory, and this goes further to your question, OIDV, and I don't want to debate the semantics of what acronym to use. That's the one that is in use for the most part, so I'll stick with it. So if I could get mandatory OIDV policy adoption, every law enforcement agency in the state, and I believe there's about 273 of them in Florida, 18,000 in the nation. But if I could get all of Florida to have to adopt an OIDV policy, not a one-size-fits-all, not the OIDV policy, but there are a number of competing policies that have been developed over the years by different entities, agencies.
What is OID?
I'm sorry, Officer-Involved Domestic Violence.
Okay, thank you.
It's the shorthand acronym that most of the DV world and the law enforcement world use to describe abuse perpetrated by law enforcement.
Got you. And so I just want to make sure too, so he had priors.
He had a prior domestic violence call that was, he wasn't arrested, he wasn't detained, he wasn't even slapped on the wrist. The only consequence on the record was he was told by his then corporal to stop dating this woman at the time, the victim. Don't date her any further, any longer.
Okay.
And by the way, he met her on a call, which is a big no-no in law enforcement. You don't respond to a traffic crash and go, oh, she's cute. Why don't I, you know, take her to dinner? But that's what he did because he's a predator, and that's what predators do.
Understood. Okay. Thank you. Joni, I don't know if you had any follow-up questions to any of that.
About 10.
No. Yeah. I have to write mine down because otherwise.
Well, I know I should have done the same thing because I just, there were so many different directions I wanted to go in. You know, one being, how aware were other officers? I mean, obviously this one officer who came up to you and essentially said, you know, this is a bad guy and has been a bad guy and I've never talked to him since this one thing happened. Was it common knowledge? I mean, do people know this guy's dating history and did he have a reputation for anything that people would have known about?
Very good question. And one I can't fully answer. I can say in the course of my journey of learning about what happened, I reached out to nearly every single person who had a touch on that particular call, that incident. And as I mentioned, he himself, I don't think I did mention, but he himself placed the initial call when he was having this incident with his then girlfriend, a woman who I can speak her name because she went public. Her name's then China Ratner. Now it's China Ratner Perkins. She's a social media influencer who had dated him. She's the one who he met on the traffic crash. She's the one who suffered untold and awful abuse of all manner at his hands, managed to get out of, from under it by leaving the county, actually. And after Abby was killed, she saw the news reports and then came out and put an Instagram video up that's very compelling about what had happened to her with him. And because of that incident report, it names the other deputies who responded when he placed that call. And I reached out to all of them. And I've met some of them personally. And they all told me that what they witnessed that night was very disturbing, that they too agreed that, you know, he was out of line and something should have been done. So I can, in response to your question, I know at least those people that were there on that call certainly were aware of his bad behavior. In addition, there's a guy who's now retired who'd been a 30-year plus veteran, hardcore, tough as nails, old school goon. They call them goons when you're an old school tough cop, you know? They call them it's goonery and goons and whatnot. The stuff that...
You're entitled. People, go ahead. It's your
yeah, I don't... Hey, it's their term. They like being called goons. But they... This guy... I knew he had been his supervisor at a certain point, so he would have knowledge about him. And like you, I wanted to know, hey, what did you know? And this guy doesn't know me from Adam. I was frankly shocked he took my call. But a lot of the Abby's death rocked them, that agency. It's a big agency. It's one of the top 10, 15 numerically numbers of sworn deputies in the country for sheriff's offices. And they were very hurt by it. And even though I didn't know him, they all know about what happened to Abby. And so he called me. I remember where I was at the time. And I knew who he was. His wife is a current deputy. His son is a deputy. I think his father was a deputy. So this is a lifelong Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office deputy family. You know, they bleed that blue. And yeah. Nonetheless, he detested Dan Layden so much, just like that other deputy 2 days after, where I could just kind of feel it coming off of him. This guy said, yeah, I was a supervisor, all right. Never liked the son of a bitch, didn't trust the son of a bitch. He told somebody else who was his successive supervisor, keep an eye on that guy. So was it well known? I can't gauge. Was it known? Absolutely. You know, so there were some who knew he was, I don't know if you'd say he was dangerous, but that there was something amiss. And I know he was an aggressive, hard-charging guy. You know, he was on the gun recovery, whatever they call it, super-duper mucho macho squads and stuff. And he liked that stuff. And he was a big guy. And but he was a smart guy, too. You know, he was a fairly cerebral guy. And it was an interesting mix. And but that he was a killer, I certainly had no indication.
Right. Was there any known substance abuse or mental health disorders that were reported?
No, none to my knowledge.
Okay.
I will say that after China Ratner's video came out, China told me that eight other women, and told the investigators from St. John's County and St. Augustine who investigated the murder, that eight other women had suffered at his hands, had dated him.
Eight other women. Wow.
Eight. Five of whom. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, how did you find that out? How did she know that?
She put her Instagram video out and they came out of the woodwork and reached out to
her.
Wow. And that's what the homicide investigator in St. John's County told me. And then she later told me that too. Like I said, I reached out to everybody, including China, with whom, funny, I thought I had a sort of positive relationship. Anything you need, Mr. Bieber, I'm so sorry. I'll be glad to help. And then she shut off the faucet and wouldn't help anymore. And I was like, okay. Because I wanted the names of those women. I wanted to talk to them. And I never got them. But they know who they are. And if they want to reach out to me, I'd love to hear from them.
I'm wondering, as you've mentioned before, you have three children, all of whom have been in law enforcement, and two of them still are in law enforcement. And so your sons certainly are in that culture, in that world. And I'm wondering what kind of sense they made of this whole thing.
No different than me, frankly. They understand the failures and the weaknesses of the system. They don't abide it. They fight against it. One of my sons is going through a medical thing right now. He's a combat veteran. He has some injuries that resurfaced a little bit, and he's getting tended to. And they put him on light duty, and he had to do some recruiting stuff. So because he's doing some office work in the recruiting sector, he's very, very careful to look for any indicators of any kind of sign, obviously, of domestic abuse at all. And he's in a position now, temporarily anyway, where he can have some sway over who comes in the door and who doesn't. And that is a huge area for improvement, obviously. And Mark Wynn, one of the nation's most celebrated experts on OIDV, will tell you that an agency that puts out an application for employment with them that has one question or two questions about domestic violence is not an agency that's doing the best for its citizens and itself, really. It should have 10 or 12 questions about domestic violence, ask different ways, coming at it from different angles, to provide those data points that can help an agency weed out the truly bad actors. And there are I can't say I've done an exhaustive study of how many of the 18,000 agencies have 10 or 12 questions and how many have one or two, but I would wager to say it's pretty safe saying it's going to be closer to the one or two, particularly in a climate of difficult recruiting, as everybody knows right now. It's hard to get cops to do this job. It's a thankless job and not a well-paying job.
What was it? What were the policy at the time? What was the kind of standard policy and understanding of if there was a domestic violence call involving an officer, then the response should be what?
You're zeroing in on the precise problem. That nobody can answer that, at least in a comprehensive, I think, useful way. There have been woefully few studies, if any, about a summary of comparative policy adoption. The International Association of Chiefs of Police, the IACP, one of the biggest conferences and organizations consolidating law enforcement policy procedure. Protocol, in 1999, developed a model policy for OIDV. A lot of labor, a lot of energy and effort and resources went into it. It was revised subsequently, 2003, just a few years later. And so glad they did it, not so glad they didn't promote it. They developed this terrific tool, and then they patted themselves on the back, put it on the shelf, and I've spoken to people who are IACP members for decades who never heard of it, don't know about it. The chief deputy at Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, a woman, one of their first chief deputy, had Mark Wynn himself speak and address them on OIDV in one of their facilities. Never heard of it. Never heard of the model policy IACP had developed. I sent it to her. So these things exist, but nobody can tell you how many agencies have adopted them in full or in part. You'll find a couple of academic studies that point to, you know, 10 or 12 states or even cities and, or agencies that have them. There's no exhaustive study. And there are those, Ruth Raimundo Mandel is one of the big OIDV domestic violence advocate. She and her husband, I think it's her husband, David Mandel, have a Safe Together Institute. I don't know if you've heard of that, but I heard her on a podcast say there's a data desert. That was her term, which I happen to like. There is a, I think it's a deliberate data desert on this topic. If you do a survey of even just a topical survey of what is OIDV, you know, just Google around and read a few papers, articles, they will all tell you there's no exhaustive authoritative collection of data on it. And I think it's deliberate, like I said, because you will eventually end up getting to the point of believing and understanding, I think, and accepting that there is a male patriarchal domination of the field, of the power, of the information. And to authorize somebody to study this, to allocate, even the OVW, the Office of Violence Against Women, a part of the Federal Department of Justice, I don't know that they've even allocated resources to study this, because it gets stepped on. The sheriffs, you know, the PBA, the unions, the organizations that represent law enforcement are going to crush it, any effort to do so, because if you do it, you have to admit you have a problem. You have to admit it exists. And then you have to maybe delegate or give up some authority, some control, some power. And at the end of the day, that's what all of this abuse, all of this domestic violence is about, right? Power and control. And as an agency, almost as a profession, they jealously guard that power and control. They alone have the levers of power and control over. And it's tough. I have a friendly police chief, a major city police chief, former chief, goes to the IACP annual convention. It was in Boston last October, and there's a major cities chiefs association sub meeting, and he wanted to advocate for OIDV and maybe get me involved in talking to these guys, and it's mostly guys, but not entirely. And he said that, you know, OID what? What is it? Never heard of it. And then he explains it. They still don't get it. And that's the lack of awareness, even amongst the professions. Now, I know also that you know how a lot of Republican members of Congress privately say they don't like Trump, but they don't say it publicly? Same thing happening with with OIDV and law enforcement. They'll privately tell you, sure, it happens. But they don't want to say it publicly.
Yeah. Sorry, Bruce. I was going to actually ask you about, like, I'm going to sidestep the politics, but we can talk about that offline. Yeah. But but I am wondering about, you know, we hear sometimes about, like, corruption in law enforcement and things like that. And do you have a sense, you know, what is your opinion, or do you have a sense that plays a role in maybe you know, the department not getting involved or kind of pushing it under the rug?
Yes and no. Yes, it's corrupt, but it's ethically and morally corrupt. It's not the kind of corruption, the rank, you know, monetary type, steal some cash from the drug dealer thing.
Right.
I'll put it this way. And Mark Wynn deserves the credit. I like the way he frames it. If you have, a night shift of cops, let's assume they're all male, and one once a month robs a bank, and one once a month deals methamphetamines, and one beats his wife, it is not hard to see and conceive that the other cops on that shift are going to turn the bank robber and the meth dealer in. They're far more loath and less quick to turn in the wife beater the woman who shows up at the monthly pizza party with a black eye again because she walked into a door or whatever nonsense they throw up. And you have to start asking yourself, well, why would that be? Why would, they're all crimes, they're all prosecutable, they're all criminal actions, they're all against the law, they're all law enforcement officers charged with the responsibility of enforcing the law. And they know that to allow a bank robber cop to go loose and continue to rob banks is to bring disgrace and discredit on their organization and erode their integrity. And, you know, this community they serve would soon lose all confidence in them, right? If they were known to let bank robber cops go free or meth dealing cops go free, but wife beating cops going free, not a problem at all. It's not even a, what are you talking about? Why would I call the chief and tell him Johnny on the night squad is beating his wife? That's Johnny's business. She can leave, right? That's their private affair. That's how they process this, not as a crime. And that has to change. So it's corrupt in that sense.
You know, I don't think that's limited to law enforcement. I mean, I think there's been this long history in our culture of seeing domestic violence as really relationship problems between two people. It's their business. They can work it out. But I want to shift gears a little bit, if it's okay with you, Bruce, and just talk about, because one of the things we look for so much of the time in our podcast is our warning signs.
Yeah.
You know, trying to help people who are, you know, in a relationship or know somebody in a relationship and those kinds of things. And I know that you had said, which is certainly not uncommon, that from the outside looking in, even closely on the outside looking in, I mean, you're seeing this guy, he's in your house, you went on vacation, that you didn't see anything. But a couple of things that I think really struck me when we were talking initially about this relationship, one being Abby's kind of reluctance to really commit in this relationship, that from the very beginning, there seemed to be something kind of off for her, and wanted to kind of get a sense from you what that was, what he was doing that was kind of putting her off. And then number two would be, you know, after she died, after she was murdered, if you talked to any of her friends that she had confided in and she had shared any of her misgivings or what was going on.
Yeah. Happy to get into that. Before we do though, I want to just loop back to one quick thing. You mentioned it's not obviously unique to the world of policing to accept domestic abuse, other fields, other disciplines, you know, doctors, lawyers, Indians, anybody. The difference, though, and I think it's an important distinction, is that they're the ones who are authorized to enforce the law and lock up people for doing the same thing when they're a civilian. So I think the hypocrisy and, you know, the sort of failure to treat everybody equally applies to cops more so. It makes it even a worse crime when a cop does it than a doctor or a lawyer. Tell that to the woman suffering, you know, right? They don't care who's doing it. But the reality is there's that added element of hypocritical behavior, and frankly, just it's outrageous to accept that. So back to Abby. Yes, there were signs. I mean, I didn't know it going in, but the love bombing thing. If I came into contact with a father or even a mother of a teenage girl just starting to dating, you know, I would. I didn't know anything about love bombing. I didn't know about the cycle of how, you know, the power and control starts taken away. Don't wear that. Don't go there. Don't see this person, stripping them away from their foundational relationships, and how that can just disintegrate and descend into horror and terror. So somebody who is just too good to believe just might be too good to believe. So that's a warning. And I've seen other domestic violence resources. The power and control wheel, you're probably familiar with that circle with the indicators. I mean, I don't know why at every high school, at every college, I mean, every, and frankly, men should have it too. Men should be aware and say, hey, you know, is this me? Do I do these things? And why shouldn't, again, just like with the OIDV policy, information's power and it's useful and it can change and shape society and outcomes. Why not get good information out there? Everybody should know what a lethality assessment, same kind of thing. If you're looking at a dating relationship, look at the some states are passing lethality assessment requirements on law enforcement when there's a domestic violence call. You know, do these factors apply? Is this woman in danger of being killed? And, you know, they gauge and prorate these things. And if you have so many of them, it informs how the cops should respond. If I'd had all of those tools available and applied them, and particularly if Abby had applied them to Dan Layden's case, I suspect she would have had a more fulsome appreciation for what a malevolent force this guy really is. But instead, she just interpreted his benevolence, kindness, courtesy as just a guy who's head over heels for her. And she was not head over heels for him. And to your question, she was constantly saying he's just way out in front of his skis. He's picking out drapes in the house that they're going to live in blissfully for, you know, till death do us part. You know, that, and she was like, dude, I might not even want to see you next week, let alone 6 months or 6 years down the road. Should have been a hint, you know, could have been a hint, I should say, maybe not should have. So I think his saccharine kindness, you know, this overbearing sweetness was masking, you know, this foreboding malevolence, but we didn't see it for what it was. I don't think she saw it for what it was, but she didn't like it. So there was something about it. She constantly had this hands off. No, you're not coming over. I told you that we had them up to our place in New Hampshire in November. Well, at Christmas time, we were back here. We had grandsons, and we have a big whoop-de-doo thing with the family. He wanted to come to our family's holiday celebration. And Abby was like, nope. And apparently that really pushed him, like pushed his buttons. And it to people like, I mean, not only people like you, but to you, that may evoke psychological, you know, upbringing, family. His, what does that say about his family life that he wanted so much to be a part of our family life? I don't know. But that's all just armchair, you know, shrinkery on our part. But she constantly pushed him back. Didn't have him over her house. I think dogs are good indicators. She had two dogs, and I don't think the dogs liked her, or liked him rather, sorry. And, you know, again, another hint. Maybe they should have dogs that detect this. And she confided, the other half of the question was, did she confide in her friends and whatnot? And we have talked to quite a few. And they basically say the same things we did. She was a fairly private person. She wasn't going to, she didn't want anybody to know she was even dating this guy in the agency because she wanted to carve out her own career and establish her own reputation on its merits. Didn't want any help from anybody. And in fact, there came a time when she was asked to do an undercover child or sex trafficking or child trafficking. I forgot which. So she was it was like a TV thing, you know, she was wired up and in a hotel room with cameras and microphones, and they set up the guy to come in, and then they were in the rooms next door, and they were going to pounce, you know, and lock him up when he said their magic words, whatever it was. And she was all excited about doing this undercover thing. And he got wind that she was doing it. And in a, what I now see as a jealous, rageful intrusion, made phone calls to the people who he knew were on the squad who were going to be in the rooms next door and said, hey, you know, I'm dating her. Be particularly careful. Watch out for her. She went off like a rocket. How dare you interrupt? This is my career. This is my life. You stay the hell out of it. She was so pissed that he dared to even step into the territory anywhere near her, which I think speaks a lot to her fierce, sort of pride and convictions. And you know, she brushed him back.
One of the things we talked about a little bit before we started recording was, you know, trying to, you know, I found myself struggling to kind of pin down those warning signs because you were saying that they were so hard to see. And yet one of the things I think I'm hearing is that Layden kind of ignored boundaries in a way or kept pushing boundaries, you know, because I was thinking if I didn't invite somebody to my house that I was dating for the holidays.
Right.
there's obviously a message in that. But if that person responded by getting mad, again, that's not, that is a red flag to me. I mean,
absolutely.
To have a conversation about what this meant about our relationship or why, or I mean, obviously that's in the context of a relationship, but it's almost like, you know, some of the things you said before when we've talked, it's almost been like he had this agenda or this in his mind, how things were going to be, how this relationship was going to go. And he was annoyed or angry when she would get in the way of that versus seeing it as a partnership or a relationship. It was more like, I'm driving things. I'm going to dictate how they go. And I'm going to be mad if you interfere with that. Or I'm not going to listen when you try to set limits. Does that
fit? Absolutely right. She's a character in a cast member in a plot that he's writing and he alone is starring in. And she's almost fungible because I know now, you know, she was at least the ninth, you know, and there were more before that. I tracked down a woman he dated when he was still in college who is a news anchor out in Iowa, an on-air TV news reader, and she didn't know that he had killed Abby and then himself, and she was shocked to hear that. And then I asked her if he'd ever betrayed any signs of violence or manipulative type behavior. She said, not at all. And then thinking about it, she said, you know what was weird, though, about him? And, you know, that's where you get the real good stuff, right, when they say when some thought like that comes over them. She said, he always wanted me to play wifey. That was her word. You know, he was still in college. She said, I had just graduated. I was starting my career. That was the same thing Abby said. And here he was, you know, wanting to pick out drapes. I think she might have actually used that very phrase. And I was like, dude, you're still in college. No, we're not going to live happily ever after. And she broke it off. And so clearly he had that in him. You know, this fast, and I think I learned it from Mark Wynn, accelerated relationships, I think was his phrase. It's apparently a known thing. I'd never heard the phrase. So again, you know, what are the tip-offs? Somebody who's sort of advancing the marital bliss agenda out of proportion to what's really happening. You know, it's the second date, dude. What are you talking about? Should we live in a two-bedroom or a three-bedroom? You know? No. That's a warning. But I wouldn't have known that.
I thought that before. Only happened with women couples, Bruce. It's a joke. I kind of want to switch gears a little bit, if it's okay with you.
Please.
Okay. We haven't talked that much about grief and about the grief process. So it's been, you said, what, three years?
3 years?
Right. Good. 3 years and some change, right? What was it like for you in the beginning, you and your family, her mother and her brothers and the, you know, maybe even the extended family in the beginning, and what is it like now?
Horrible.
Yeah.
Beyond, you know, There are fathers and mothers and families, and then there are fathers and mothers and families. You know, some are close, some are not so close, some are moderately close. We gathered here in this house every weekend, you know, and had a themed dinner. And, we'd pick a flavor, pick a continent, pick a country, and then we'd do, you know, food and drinks and snacks and maybe even costumes and stuff. Not crazy costumes, but just token representations of a culture, just trying to have a good reason to get together and have some fun. And it always was music, you know, we picked the music that went along with it. And, you know, we still do it, you know, it's a huge black hole, a gaping, cavernous emptiness that is always going to be there. I think, Joni, I said to you that I can somehow bifurcate in my mind in a sort of dispassionate way. I can speak to you guys clinically about this and not be a sobbing mess. They're not far. You don't always know what's going to trigger it, but I feel like I have a purpose when I talk about Abby, and it's generally twofold: to make sure her name isn't erased, and to see that I do any and everything I can to stop it from happening to somebody else. Along the way, sure, I crater, I crumble, we collapse, and none of us fight the crying, you know, the sobbing. We know that it's healthy and necessary. We also respect each other's grief styles and patterns. None of us are the same, so we understand everything's different. But we, thank God, my wife and I think, are very much aligned in our grief patterns. We'll be doing something, and we're thinking the same thing for the same reason. It's, you know, but that's a function of 150.
What do you think has helped you the most?
That's an interesting question. You have to have a reason to get up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm retired, and I'm a motorcycle guy. I'm a builder guy. Abby wanted to do a ton of things. She has a little starter house, not far, a mile and a half from here. We had big plans to do a lot of things over there, and those plans were obviously dashed. I have two other sons with houses, and, you know, I do my handy stuff over there. But fully a third, or maybe more, because she was the one who wanted to learn more and do more with me. She wasn't one to just have me do it and say, oh, thanks, it's done. She wanted to roll up her sleeves. I mean, when she got a driver's license, I said, great, take that tire off that car yourself. I mean, because you're not going out on the road until you know how to change a flat. And show me how. And she did it all. I didn't touch it. Not the jack, nothing, the whole thing. And she was so proud of being able to do all these things for it by herself. And she wanted to learn how to do the things that we would have done over there. So here's a useful thing. I had a conversation with somebody just yesterday who's got a grief thing going on. And somebody told it to me, or I read it soon after Abby was killed. And it's this grief in a ball thing. It's a visual image that I respond to.
I've heard of that.
Okay, it's a ball in a box, right? A hot burning sphere of pain and suffering, agony. That's the grief ball. It's in a box, the six sides all around. It's touching all sides. It's painful all day, every day, for every second, because it's touching all six sides. And then I have some friends came and said, you know, we want to go golfing. You'd hardly know I was holding the right end of the club the way I golf. And I'm no golfer, but I went. And, you know, okay, fine. You got away for a couple of hours and a little ray of light penetrates. And, you know, that wasn't so terrible. You want to do it again? Yeah, okay, we'll do it again. So one side of the six of the box has grown a half an inch. So the ball isn't touching that side all day, every day. And then you grow another side. We go somewhere. We do something with the grandkids, somebody else, some other friends. Who the heck knows what you do? But you don't wallow and in a pit of despair and dark, gloomy, you know, sadness. You do something. And frankly, for me, talking to you, talking to people who have suffered, talking to people who want to do better and leave a better planet, and God forbid, save a life. I always feel better personally with my personal grief when I feel like I'm pushing that, not the grief ball, but the other sports ball down the field to a victory. Wherein, do you know the Gabby Petito story, right?
Yes.
They live in Hillsborough County now. Her biological mom and stepdad live right next door, and we met.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't either till I reached out to them. People kept telling me, you know, you should talk to them. You should talk to them. And Gabby was killed just months before Abby, and he too killed himself, and they too lost a child. They had no sense they were about to lose. I mean, this sudden bolt from the blue.
Yeah.
So I've come to know them a little bit. And if you saw the recent Netflix piece, you know.
Yeah, I did watch that and actually thought about them as we have been building this podcast. And, you know, there isn't much out there by them. So it's going to be interesting to hear maybe your perspective on how they're doing. Yeah.
Well, in the course of it, I don't remember if it was Nikki or Jim, but one or both of them said words to the effect that so many people have come up to them and said, you know, I got out of a bad relationship because of what I heard you do or your foundation did or said or something they read. And I know I can speak for them when I say that that is a tremendously rewarding feeling. I haven't had that feeling. Nobody's, you know, going to come up to me, or maybe they will someday. I don't know. But the truth remains that if I can use my time to get to a point where that's the kind of thing that happens, I will never ever say it will help. It will have all been worthwhile. There's nothing I would, you know, say it was worth my daughter, you know, getting wiped off the face of the earth. But it's the next best thing, you know, to save a life. And that, after all, is what certainly what she was working towards and did. You know, she herself did. And it's the highest order achievement I think I could make of the rest of my life is to save somebody else's. So,
right.
And spare some other family from going through this. Because trust me, you just don't want to. There's no reason. And it's avoidable. That's the horror. And I've had, I don't know, Joni, how far down this path I went with you, but the sheriff of Hillsborough County, you know, when, in the immediate aftermath of Abby's murder, was all about Mr. Bieber. What can I do? Anything? We're here for you, and calling me and checking in and this and that. And then when I started doing my inquiries and started finding out some of the nonsense they were aware of, are aware of, the lies, and each one uncovered another one. You know, do you know that they built a break room? Do you know this? They in her District 3 headquarters, they asked us, would you contribute some of Abby's personal effects that represented her life so we can populate these cubbies and decorate this room in her honor, because all the people that knew her best and worked with her obviously suffered the loss too. So we were, of course we will, happy to. So we went through our stuff, we brought some stuff to them, they put it in the thing, they invited us to the grand opening that the sheriff himself was going to be at for their Christmas holiday party. And they said, would we come to the Christmas holiday party? He'd do some jabbering and they'd unveil the room. And we were like, you know, not really in the party mood, but we'll happily come by before then quietly and see it. So we did. And it was done very tastefully. It was very nice, very sweet. Good for them. Months later, I'm now on my, I don't want to say war path, but I'm on my inquiry learning journey and finding out some of the nonsense they have done and the lies and the deceit. And now I'm not friends with him anymore. He's not calling me anymore. And I the Tampa Bay Times did a piece. They did a very good piece of reportage on Abby's case that obviously insulted him, offended him. And he's a very, very charismatic public figure here. I don't know if you know who he is, but Chad Chronister. All about the image, all blah, blah, blah. And he's so petty that in response to the Tampa Bay Times piece, he ordered that the break room be disassembled and stripped apart. And they, when asked, why did you do that? The official response was the sheriff can't have district offices spending money without authorization. And I have emails saying, can you come to the grand opening with the sheriff? He knew they did it. He obviously knew they did it. It's a lie. It's just yet another lie. And a petty one at that. So anyway, that's the kind of idiocy that we deal with rather than save a life, for God's sake.
It almost sounds like that's, you know, would be like a secondary trauma, you know, because I remember you talking about before when you and I talked about just the fact that the you got a lot of support initially until you started asking questions about what really happened.
Are you ready
and what do people know? And
you ready for tertiary trauma? If that was secondary, the other deputies, when this happened in St. John's County in St. Augustine, they were in an Airbnb. All the bedrooms were upstairs. Abby wasn't even sleeping in the same room with the guy. She was sleeping on a couch in the common area. Somehow he induced her to come into the room that he was staying in, at which time he locked the door and shot her in the head 3 times, and then he shot himself. And the other deputies retreated. I don't know if I told you this, Joni. They went to a back bedroom bathroom behind at least two, I think maybe three doors, and called 911 and hid. Now, that's what I would do, and maybe you would do, but they're cops. And there's an expectation that when trouble surfaces, you do something. Uvalde, Parkland, anybody. Well, these deputies hid in the closet for almost 2 hours. 2 hours. We didn't know them. Like I said, we'd only moved here months before. We hadn't met them. These were some of Abby's friends. We met them at the funeral. We hugged them, cried with them. They were filled with trepidation that we would blame them, you know, for what happened, for not stopping it. But we had no reason to think they had anything to do with it. And we did legitimately think it, this was not your fault. You know, you couldn't have known. We didn't know. Abby didn't know. And we, you know, we cried and so on and so forth. But then in the days and weeks thereafter, they'd come by the house and whatnot and chat about it. And we started asking more questions. And I don't know who it was. Somebody asked, hey, by the way, did you guys have your guns with you? Because cops frequently carry their weapons even when they're off duty. Some are required to. And they said, no, we didn't. Two of the guys had brought their guns on this vacation, but they were packed up downstairs. They couldn't get to them. Well, I went on my learning journey, and among other things, I got the public records from St. Johns County, including the transcripts and the actual audio recording of the call, the 911 call for the 2 hours they were in the closet. And those St. Johns County cops, of course, needed to know who has a gun. Where are the guns? You're cops. We understand you guys are cops. Somebody's been shot. We don't know who. We don't know what. We got to go in this house. They need the information. Well, one of them had a gun on him in the closet for 2 hours. So I was re-traumatized then, because now the people who were her friends who were there lied to my face and my wife's face and my son's face multiple times about being armed or not. Is it relevant? You tell me. I don't know. She was dead. She was dead instantly. There's nothing they could have done. But they didn't know that then. They hid in a closet for 2 hours. I put that in front of the sheriff. I said, don't you care? You're the leader of this law enforcement organization. Does it mean anything to you that your deputies hid in a closet for 2 hours? There are lots of cops told me they would have been fired immediately. And it's not for everybody. Listen, I'm not saying I would go charging in and doing anything. You know, I'm not a cop. I'm not a trained law enforcement officer. But I know those that are say not only would they have a duty to. And I find that galling, that he dismisses it and essentially tells me to mind my own business. My daughter's dead. And I told him, that's forever, Chad, forever. You know, and I wouldn't want to be on the street with those cops. They didn't back their friend up. They're not going to back you up.
I just wanted to thank you again, Bruce. And I'd like to get to know you a little more and talk to you offline for sure. I have so many more questions I know we don't have time for. As we do close up, I just, you know, wanted to remind maybe people who are watching this that have been impacted by murder, suicide, loss, whether you are a family member or a friend, that you can reach out to us at the murdersuicideloss.networks.com. And then Bruce, if somebody wanted to get involved in the OID policy movement, or, you know, they wanted to learn more, is there a website or something they can go to?
Yeah, I would go to Mark Wynn's website. He's got a lot of resources on there. Mark Wynn is WYNN. He's a former Nashville cop. And Dottie Davis has a wealth. Dottie is a former deputy chief at the Indianapolis Police Department. Very prolific speaker, noted expert on the field. Both of them, Mark Wynn and Dottie Davis, have websites that are tremendous
Dottie
resources.
Davis.
Dottie Davis. And I will also say, if you don't mind, Joni, you asked me a question last week. I really wasn't prepared to, when we last talked, that I wasn't prepared to answer. You know, what would a person in crisis do? Who should they call? Who should they reach out to? And I said, that's beyond the scope of my expertise. I'm not that person. I'm more of an advocate for the policy changing. But I do know, and I should have thought to say, if there is a family justice center in your area, they consolidate resources of all kinds from in a multidisciplinary way, so that particularly a woman who's really in crisis. When it's a cop, it's awful when it's a civilian. When it's a cop, it's worse because you're calling the cops to report a cop and you just know that's not going to end well, and it frequently doesn't. But a family justice center has law enforcement there that should be disassociated from, you know, whatever's happening to this woman, hopefully. And that might be a good response. I would defer, of course, to experts who know what kind of lines.
I think it might be important at some point for us to actually list all of those, the National Domestic Violence Hotline, the National Suicide Hotline, and all of that. So I think we'll add that to our page, probably all of those resources. Thank you, Bruce.
My great pleasure.
And is there anything else that we left off that, you know, in short, that you'd like for the listeners to know?
I think there's value in writing to your local representatives, you know, to get the issue out there, get them thinking about it. I've done it here, and I've got a guy who's supposedly pushing things on a local level and trying to get stuff into the Tallahassee State House. And people need to be socialized into the vernacular, into the word, into the problem, the phenomenon. I mean, you got to know you have a problem before you can start fixing it, right?
100%. Thank you so much, Bruce.
Thank you.
Joni, do you have any last thoughts?
I just wanted to thank you also, Bruce, again, for, you know, just sharing your story. And also just, you know, sitting here thinking today so much as you were talking about how proud Abby would be of the work that you're doing. It sounds like you are really honoring not just what happened to her, but just who she was as a person and her spirit. And I know that she's
had a lot of both.
Super proud of her dad.
Yeah. Yep. It just reminds me why we do this. And I want to thank everyone for being here and joining us for each episode. And again, you can join us at murdersuicidelossnetwork.com to find out more. You can learn more about support groups, and you can see more of our podcasts here. So thank you so much, Joni. Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye. Thank you.